Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is the Dry Cleaner Cast. Welcome to the Dry Cleaner Cast, a podcast that takes a new look at the war on terror, its legacy, and espionage in the 21st century. This podcast is written, edited, and presented by Chris Carr.
On this month's episode, we take a look at the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. Authors Paul Anderson and Kevin Davey join me to discuss their book, Moscow Gold, which looks at the relationship between the Soviet Union and the British left. Comrades, I hope you enjoy.
Opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the filmmakers and sponsors of the film, The Dry Cleaner.
Paul and Kevin, welcome to The Dry Cleaner Cast.
Hi there.
Hi.
Guys, it'd be great for the benefit of our listeners for you to both just tell us a bit about yourselves. Paul, we'll start with you.
Hello, well, and thanks for having us. I'm a journalist and an academic. I've spent 30 years of my life working as a journo on various lefty publications. I was editor of the Weekly Tribune in the early 90s and deputy editor of the New Statesman after that. And I've been teaching journalism and history at various universities since the late 1990s, as well as freelancing, writing books, and working as a sub-editor on The Guardian.
Kevin, can you also just tell us a bit about yourself?
Well, I have a rather different profile. I'm a consultant to businesses in Shoreditch, and I work with social enterprises all over the southeast of England. But if you go back to the 70s and the 80s, I was an activist and a writer on the left. In the 80s, I became much more involved in running organizations, the Socialist Society, the Socialist Conference. I helped set up Charter 88. I worked alongside very closely many of the people who are now in the leadership of the Labour Party. And subsequently, I've gone on to write about the left. And one of the most recent books is Moscow Gold, which we've written about the history of Soviet involvement in the Labour Party in Britain.
Thank you for that. We're close to the 100th anniversary of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution that led to the creation of the Soviet Union. 100 years on, we can now see that the legacy of the Bolshevik Revolution went on to shape the political landscape of the 20th century and arguably set the stage for the geopolitical events of the 21st century. On today's show, we're going to focus on the relationship between the Soviet Union and the British left. Before we begin, I think it'd be a good idea to get a quick guide to certain key terms which frequently get confused with each other or get equated with each other as a point of criticism. Paul, can you just tell us what is communism, what is socialism, what is liberalism, and does being on the left automatically mean that you're a communist?
Well, I think that's rather a big question. And, actually, I think you get as many different answers as there are people who describe themselves as socialists, communists, and liberals. And, it's also, to complicate matters, different in different times and different places. For what it's worth, for me, socialism is essentially a belief in egalitarianism and extension of democratic control to as much of everyday life as we can extend it to. Communism is a commitment to state control of just about everything under a totalitarian dictatorship, and liberalism is a matter of tolerance and acceptance of rights and rules of democratic procedure. There are plenty of socialists who would say that my definition is far too woolly, and there are communists who abhor everything about the official communisms of the Soviet Union and China, And, well, just to complicate things even more, what it means to be a liberal is completely different in the US and Europe. Liberals in the US are all in favour of what I'd call social democratic amelioration of the ills of capitalism. But continental European liberals are mad for the free market and not much else. So, well, OK, and British liberals are somewhere in between. So, OK, I'm not answering the question, just saying it's a bit complicated.
I mean, I've collaborated with Paul for more than 30 years now, and I always find it amazing that we still disagree on just about everything, which is great. And I think Paul's definition of communism is the definition of communism as it turned out to be. I think I'll be a little more generous and say that it's the aspiration to. It's an aspirational, classless society. Unlike Paul, I think that the aspiration involves no state. I think it involves a withering away of the state, the famous phrase. I think the aspiration involves material sufficiency for all. It even, in many cases, is a vision of a moneyless society. But I do think that that aspirational notion of communism is a direction of travel which has actually brought about its opposite for most of the parties that have set out in that direction. And I agree that totalitarianism and dictatorship have often been the result of setting out on the journey towards that aspiration. On socialism, I think we probably have a very similar view, which is that I think very much socialism is about state direction of the economy, of much of industry, of utilities and services. But it's also about popular control of the state, a form of social organisation for the many, not the few, to use a contemporary phrase. On liberalism, I think it's a very stretchy term. I think it's a mix of political democracy and different levels of regulation of a mixed economy with lots of options and diverse structures possible within it, but probably no major shifts of power or resources envisaged by liberals. So our working definitions are similar but not the same.
I would now like us to go back in time to 1917 at the beginning of the Bolshevik Revolution. Paul and Kevin, can you just talk us through what was going on in the world and Russia during that time and how the Bolshevik Revolution came to be?
Well, rather a lot was happening in 1917. The Bolshevik Revolution wouldn't have happened, I think it's fair to say, had it not been for the First World War, which was catastrophic for Russia. Russia won initial victories against Germany and against Austria-Hungary with its massive conscript army, and then lost battle after battle. I'm simplifying the story. But by the end of 1916, early 1917, the morale of its army had collapsed. The Tsarist regime had lost all credibility with its people at the front and at home, and it surrendered power in February 1917, the first Russian Revolution of 1917, after not much more than a couple of demonstrations in the streets of Petrograd. We're not talking about an insurrection of classical proportions. The Bolshevik Revolution 9 months later was a different kettle of fish. It was an opportunist coup. The Bolsheviks had support among the workers, were promising peace and food, but it wasn't a mass movement. Lenin and his comrades seized the moment and did so very, very effectively.
What was the initial British political reaction to the Russian Revolution? And did attitudes change in the months after the fact?
I think that the fall of the Tsar was welcomed by just about everybody at governing level. The leaderships of the Conservatives, the Liberals and the Labour Party, we're talking Bona Law, Lloyd George, Arthur Henderson, all welcomed the toppling of that regime. But at the same time, they also wanted Russia to continue in the war. Within a year, Russia was out, so their attitude certainly did change at that point. The left who opposed the war were thrilled by the news from Russia. These were organisations like the Union for Democratic Control, which stood for peace and no annexations, the mostly pacifist Independent Labour Party, the British Socialist Party, Sylvia Pankhurst's workers' suffrage movement. These were all very optimistic at the news, limited as it was, that was coming across from Russia. And after the Bolshevik Revolution, these are groups that went on to rally at the Albert Hall and get involved in the Leeds Convention and generally try and develop a partner for the Bolsheviks in the United Kingdom. I suppose the significant impact that we point out in Moscow Gold is that Arthur Henderson visits Russia in the summer of 1917, and he comes back much more sympathetic to the notion of a peace conference of the warring powers, and in fact drives Labour policy towards the idea that once this war is over, that will be the end of war. There will be no more, and the League of Nations will be the vehicle to deliver that. But at the same time, Henderson had also seen the disorganisation and maladministration and chaos in Russia in this period, and he led a simultaneous push, really, to create an electorally focused Labour Party with individual membership that was focused on parliament, on town halls and local authorities, and was not insurgent and revolutionary. So again, there was a political reaction to the Russian Revolution, which was to say that's not the path that Labour will be taking in Britain. I suppose it would be fair to say that nobody actually expected the Bolshevik Revolution of the autumn to last. And as the Bolsheviks went on to negotiate a separate peace at Brest-Litovsk, allowing Germany to begin to move troops westward, that came as an enormous shock to public opinion and the British establishment. The Bolsheviks turned out not to be allies, and public opinion swung against them.
Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Paul?
I suppose the only thing really is to say that what's most extraordinary about the British take on what was happening in Russia in 1917-1918, so after the Bolshevik coup d'etat, the Bolshevik Revolution, was just how little was known. The best coverage was actually written by one Arthur Ransom, who listeners might have heard of because of, Swallows and Amazons and his later children's books. But he was then the Petrograd correspondent of the Daily News and was in London in late 1917 to have, an operation because he was ill. And his coverage from London was better than anything that appeared from the front line, so to speak. It wasn't really until early 1918 that anything like an accurate picture of what had happened in Russia was formed by anyone in the UK. And then from mid-1918, we're looking at British intervention to suppress the Bolshevik Revolution, which meant that nothing came out because of censorship. So, ignorance was the norm.
1918 to 1920, Britain was in a state of undeclared war with the Bolshevik regime. Can you tell us a bit about that time?
Well, the British intervention against the Bolsheviks has been written about a lot, and it was undoubtedly a massive issue in domestic politics at the time. But actually, it didn't really amount to much. The Brits sent a force to northern Russia, Murmansk and Arkhangelsk, early on in 1918, but they basically spent most of their time doing nothing, freezing in defensive positions and complaining about their circumstances. There was some ineffectual gunboat diplomacy and a little bit of derring-do in the Baltic. There was a farcical attempt to invade Siberia in league with the Japanese, in which and the Americans, in which the Brit garrison of Hong Kong, all soldiers over the age of 40 and rather small in number, well, they played a minor but nevertheless a leading role for a few months. And in the deep south of Russia, the RAF flew a few sorties in surplus sop with camels in support of the counter-revolutionaries. Rather more honourably, the Brits protected the independent socialist Republic of Georgia for a while, but gave that up and let the Bolsheviks invade and take it over. To cut long story short, no one in the UK really had any heart for intervention against the Bolsheviks after the end of the war in Western Europe in late 1918, apart from Winston Churchill. Against the intervention, there was a massive campaign calling for hands off Russia, which was led by the trade unions, who were motivated more by war weariness than sympathy for the new Soviet regime. Communists and anti-communists have made a big deal of the hands-off Russia moment. I'm afraid I don't think it's too important. It didn't leave a great lasting impact.
In 1920, the Communist Party of Great Britain was founded. On the eve of its birth, Vladimir Lenin declared communists should demand an electoral pact with Labour, only so that they could expose Labour politicians as class traitors. So maybe not the best start. Can you tell us about the forming of the Communist Party of Great Britain and how it was received?
Well, I think one of the first things that the supporters of the Bolsheviks in Britain do, apart from holding welcoming conventions and celebrations, is that they tap the new regime for cash, quite a lot, in fact. The equivalent to a couple of million pounds today, and that money in the form of gold and jewels starts to arrive in Britain in the summer of 1920. People like Rothstein and Pankhurst are instrumental in bringing the wealth in, and in fact that kind of Moscow gold, the generous expense account from 1920-21 onwards, was still coming through as pocket money for the party in 1979 when Paul and I were students. So it was the beginning of quite a lot of leveraged support in the UK from that period onwards. But the unity conventions were optimistic events held by the Bolshevik inclined left in London and in the north. But everybody that joined in the formation of the Communist Party of Great Britain had to agree quite an onerous 21 political conditions to become part of the new party, part of the Third International, its kind of outpost in the United Kingdom. And this involved them committing to break with reformism, to break with the practices of the Labour Party and its parliamentary orientation, to challenge and break with the normal trade union approaches to negotiations with capital. It required new supporters to conform to the notion and to develop the practice of the dictatorship of the proletariat. And overall, arching over all of these commitments, the local party had to submit to the interests and decisions of the international. The Independent Labour Party at the time considered its options but decided not to bend its knee to these terms. The Labour Party itself, of course, was rather appalled at what was going on. The new party's attitude to the Labour Party was very much that of Lenin's. The Labour Party was an imperialist party that had supported the war and was part of the problem facing communists, but the party was born nonetheless in 1921, and it was a micro party. It was a collection of fragments that didn't fit together particularly well for a number of years. It included the British Socialist Party, the Socialist Labour Party, supporters of the Daily Herald, Welsh miners, Clydeside engineers and shipbuilders, and for a little while Pankhurst's workers' suffrage movement. Together they spent the money on property. They bought the King Street office, professional organisers across the country, and a newspaper, the Communist. And the ILP remained in the Communist Party's sights as a possible acquisition. But as Paul indicated, after Kronstadt, after the attack on the soldiers and sailors rising in Kronstadt, and after the invasion of the Menshevik Republic in Georgia, most of the ILP turned their backs on the Communist Party and its approaches permanently. So the early Communist Party split the left. It was also highly polarised against the fast-growing Labour Party. And all in all, I think that's rather a bad start for the party, unless you think a scrap and a long-term confrontation with the bulk of the British left and its Labour movement is a way forward.
It's quite difficult to think of the first 5 years of the Communist Party of Great Britain, except in terms of farce. It had oodles of cash. It had fashionable supporters. It had premises in the centre of London's media quarter, and it achieved precisely nothing.
I think one thing worth pointing out is that the British Labour movement and the new Bolsheviks assembling in Britain are chalk and cheese. I mean, the political perspectives of the Third International and the struggle for a dictatorship of the proletariat and the emerging parliamentary politics, still very much engaged with the social unrest and strikes of the period, are extremely different. But the Communist Party keeps asking to affiliate. You know, the chalk of Labour knew that that Labour and Bolshevism were incompatible, and it kept saying no. But the Communist Party didn't stop asking to be part of the Labour Party for decades.
In 1923, Labour formed a minority government. That government fell apart after a vote of no confidence was passed against the then Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald. The reason why there was a vote of no confidence was he refused to hold an inquiry into why the government chose to recognise the Soviet Union politically as their first foreign act when they came into government, which is obviously quite controversial at that time. Then 4 days before the 1924 election, Britain experienced its first Red Scare when the then Daily Mail published an explosive letter called the Zinoviev Letter. Paul, can you tell us about this time?
The first thing that's crucially important is that the Zinoviev Letter was a fake. It was purportedly a missive from the head of the Communist International, the Third International, the International Communist Organization. Grigory Zinoviev was its chief. But in fact, it was fabricated. It was a fake news operation set up almost certainly by white Russian opponents of the Bolsheviks. And, well, the story of how it was used in the UK is really quite extraordinary. It was essentially a call to arms for communists to overthrow the British state. And even though it was a fake, the security services, the Daily Mail and the Tory party spun it as definitive proof that Ramsay MacDonald, the leader of the Labour Party and, of course, Prime Minister in 1924, was a Soviet stooge. Which, well, actually, even if the thing had been genuine, it wouldn't have proved that, but that's another matter. I don't think it lost Labour the 1924 election in itself, but Labour's openness to trade and diplomatic relations with Moscow, and it, you know, it was very definitely open to both, made it vulnerable to Red Scare tactics from its opponents. And frankly, Labour didn't really help itself very much during the 1920s.
Can you just tell us a bit about who the White Russians are, and was the letter known to be a fake at the time?
White is white rather than red, and nothing to do with Belarus, so which is White Russia. The Whites were the anti-Bolshevik counter-revolutionaries, if you like, who mounted an armed rebellion against the Bolshevik regime, and the civil war that resulted was probably the bloodiest conflict in terms of deaths per capita of the 20th century. I could be wrong about that, but the number of deaths from military action and starvation was absolutely extraordinary. Essentially, they lost. The Bolsheviks won by 1920-21. They went into exile, but they didn't stop plotting against the Bolshevik regime, and the Zinoviev letter is essentially a piece of black propaganda from the Whites, if you know what I mean. It was denounced as a fake at the time by everybody on the left and in the Labour Party, but no one could be quite sure, because it was actually quite a good fake. What Zinoviev had actually said in missives to the Communist Party of Great Britain had been not far from calls to insurrection against His Majesty's government, as then was. It was plausible, but it was the way it was spun rather than the actual content of the letter that was crucially important.
Let's move on to the 1920s. 1927 saw the 10th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. A delegation of British and international politicians visited Russia, and many were amazed by what they saw. These politicians came back praising Russia, seeing signs of the Soviet Union settling down under the leadership of Joseph Stalin. In that year also, the Communist Party changed track with a more aggressive line against the social democratic parties and reformist trade unions in the UK. Later in 1929, we had the Wall Street crash, which led to mass unemployment both in the US and the UK. Can you talk us through how the events of 1927 and 1929 shaped the Communist Party in the UK?
Well, Stalin was in control by 1927, and the big new project, the big new push to build the Third International was something that was called the Third Period, a period of class against class clarity in the labour movements wherever the Communist Party was active. And this really meant that a turn against reformism was ordered in Western Europe, and in Britain, of course, that meant a severe critique and campaign of opposition to the British Labour Party, and indeed to the organised trade unions. This was, of course, made a lot easier in Britain, because the Labour Party and the TUC had both led the movement to a very significant defeat in the general strike of 1926. And the argument of the third period communists was that Labour was giving false hope to reforms and reformism amongst the working class, and they took steps to set up separate revolutionary trade unions, the National Minority Movement, and to challenge the Labour Party wherever it could. In Britain, Pollitt argued at public meetings, down with conservatism, with liberalism, and with labourism. Of course, one of the beneficiaries from this international turn was the fascist movement, active and in a position of power in Italy, becoming stronger in Germany at this time. And I think that it's an indication, really, of the fact that the Communist International never really understood fascism, and perhaps never has done. It saw fascism as the last gasp of capitalism, a sign that it was time for the final push by the revolutionary working class. But in fact, you know, fascism was a mass movement. It was a mass movement that continued after the defeats of the post-war period and the 20s, and in Italy and in Germany it grew while the communists attacked the centre-left, the reformist left, the social democratic parties across Europe. And their argument was very much that if capitalism was on its last legs, the last partners they needed at a moment like that was people that were not committed to end it. And so instead of the wide partnership needed to resist the development of fascism, what we had was a fractured left. And as we know, fascism comes to be very dominant in Italy, in Germany, in Spain, and later on to threaten Britain and the rest of Europe. It was a huge shot in the foot. It was an act of real self-harm. It did nothing to resist the rise of fascism. And by the summer of 1930, there were only about 2,500 members in the Communist Party of Great Britain. In other words, fewer than when it started nearly 10 years before. And one of the consequences is that Labour, by the early 1930s, is not cooperating with the Communist Party, turning down those knocks on the door for affiliation, which continue. And trade unions are proscribing communists from office in their ranks. So 1927 was an act of self-harm that clearly weakened the party. But then we had the Wall Street crash in 1929, and this really punctured Western capitalism, ruptured the global economy massively. And of course, at this point, Stalin's planned economy and the growth that it was reporting began to look quite attractive to people in Labour circles and beyond. It looked particularly good to the starry-eyed visitors that went across in the 1930s, for whom a very good show was put on with the model villages and the endless feasts of statistics, the Webbs, Shaw, Pritt, Labour delegations, trades councils all go over and believe that they've seen a vision of a planned socialist future. And this, of course, does help to reposition and place the party in quite a positive light. But really, by no merit of its own at all, the Communist Party of Great Britain is associated with what appears to be a better way, a better economic future that's opening up in the East.
The 1930s were a highly eventful time for the Communist Party in the UK and across the world. We had the rise of fascism in Europe and Imperial Japan in the East. We also had the Spanish Civil War in 1936, in which thousands of volunteers formed international brigades against the fascists. But despite the rise in popularity of communism in 1932, two journalists reported back that the Soviet Union was using forced labour, which had led to the deaths of millions of people. This was in stark contrast to the earlier positive reports in 1927. Yet these reports fell on deaf ears and in many cases were covered up. Can you tell us about this complex time and why people chose to turn a blind eye to the reports of exploitation and mass deaths in the Soviet Union?
This is a hard one. I've been wondering about this for a rather long time. Part of the story, it seems to me, the non-story, it's non-reporting of the Ukrainian famine in the early 1930s. Part of the story is that Western correspondents in Moscow preferred to keep their contacts in the party state apparatus suite rather than tell the truth that they all knew. They told the same lies that they were writing in their reports to official visitors. Everything in the garden was rosy. But it wasn't quite as simple as that. It's also a matter, and, well, actually the same thing goes for the show trials and purges of the late 1930s, when Stalin managed to, well, kill essentially, well, his own generation of Bolshevik leaders, plus several hundred thousand others. But part of the kind of Moscow correspondence, Western Moscow correspondence cover-up was also that they and the wide-eyed fellow travellers from the West, they were writing for readers in the UK, the US and Western Europe who really wanted Soviet socialism to work and who dreamed their dreams vicariously. Western capitalism, as Kevin was saying, appeared to have failed. Its only saviour, the populist authoritarianism of fascism. So lefties in the West wanted the Soviet regime to succeed. The Soviet Union was anti-fascist, at least until 1939, and it seemed to have positive stories to tell about socialist progress. And a large part of the Western left and a large number of Western liberals wanted to hear the best about an alternative, even if the stories were propagandist lies.
I'd like us to take a look at World War II. At the beginning, the Soviet Union formed a non-aggression pact with Nazi Germany. This moment challenged many British communists. Then that pact fell apart in 1941, and the Soviet Union became an allied partner in the fight against Germany. Can you tell us about the impact the non-aggression pact had on the Communist Party, and then the later reaction to Russia changing sides in the war?
For a decade of campaigning against fascism and opposing appeasement, the Communist Party had won over some support, had some success with the Labour left. There were figures like Cripps and Strachey and Galansk and the Left Book Club that had been included into these campaigns and were in a romance of sorts with the Communist Party at the time. But, you know, the Communist Party was a dog on a leash, really. It was free to run through the 1930s in the anti-fascist park. But the moment came when the Soviet Union called the dog to heel and tugged it and took it home to become a buddy with Hitler. The Molotov-Ribbentrop agreement in August 1939 and the subsequent joint plunder of Poland by Germany and by the Soviet Union really was a shocking event in the eyes of Communist Party members of the Labour movement more generally in Britain. The instruction came through from the Soviet Union that the war was in fact an imperialist war and to be opposed by communists in Britain, and Harry Pollitt, the leader at the time, actually ignored this. He suppressed the instructions for a short period of time, but he was soon forced to stand down, as indeed was the editor of the Daily Worker, for, as we know, obedience to the Third International was an obligation of membership and of communist parties, and to give up on the fight against fascism was in fact the opposite of what many Communist Party members had signed up for. Labour's shock was intense at the realisation that Russia and the Communist Party were leaving the battlefield. Conservatives never really expected anything else. But some Labour figures like Cripps gave the Soviet Union the benefit of the doubt, accepting the argument that the Soviet Union needed time to rearm. But basically, the Communist Party was instructed to defend a remote workers' state that was not under attack at the time, while not defending Holland, Norway, France. And in fact, it even went as far at many points as to suggest that Britain was becoming fascist in its response to the German threat and the way that it was organising the war. Labour gets on with the fight against fascism. It enters Churchill's government, engages in the war, and of course then in 1941 the game is turned on its head. The Germans invade the Soviet Union, and the message comes through from Moscow that the war is an anti-fascist war and must be given the support of communists in Britain. Communist Party, the dog on the leash, Moscow gives it a tug, and the party is now a leading agency in promoting the urgency of the war against the fascists and the production drive in the factories to produce munitions and urgent prosecution of the war and opening of a second front. It's it wags its tail and membership booms. It reaches 56,000 by 1942, a high point, and it grows a little bit more after that. It's moment of peak popularity. It was genuinely helping to meet the British needs of the time, and frankly there wasn't much left by then of the original Bolshevik insurrectionary origins and ideas of the communist movement. Its aims were becoming increasingly the same as those of the Labour Party, but nevertheless it took its lead from Moscow. Communist Party carried on trying to affiliate to the Labour Party, and the Labour Party continued to knock those requests back.
Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Paul?
Just a couple of things. I suppose, the first thing on the Hitler-Stalin pact in 1939, it wasn't something that lost the Communist Party a great number of members, but it lost it all of its credibility among, I suppose, thinking leftists. So the intellectuals, the Galantzes, the Strakes, and so forth, for them 1939 was the end, and they never ever trusted the Communist Party ever again. Bizarrely, after 1941 you see the Communist Party raking up support for its patriotism, for its siding with Uncle Joe Stalin and the Red Army's heroic defiance of Nazism in Eastern Europe. That's the point that's looked back on by communists ever after as the golden age of the Popular Front, the anti-fascist Popular Front. But actually, it was all downhill from there.
After World War II, the Western powers grew increasingly suspicious of the Soviet Union, and tensions increased to breaking point in 1947, which saw the start of the Cold War, which lasted through until 1991. The Cold War saw many historic events, from the building of the Berlin Wall, the war between North and South Korea, the United States and the Soviet arms race, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Prague Spring, the Vietnam War, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, as well as multiple spy scandals in the UK, Europe, USA and Russia. And this is just to name a few events of the Cold War. The Soviet Union was politically at odds with the West on almost every issue. What happened? This is a big question. What happened to the Communist Party and the British left during the Cold War?
That's what's called rather a big question, and it's very difficult to give a simple answer. The Communist Party of Great Britain declined, broadly speaking, from the mid-1940s right the way through to the 1980s and, hit terminal crisis in the mid-1980s and gave up the ghost in 1991. Remnants of the tradition organised in various minuscule groups, the most important of them in the Orthodox communist tradition, the Communist Party of Britain, not the same thing as the Communist Party of Great Britain, but they survive, very, very small number of people involved. They've got the Morning Star daily newspaper, various bureaucrats in some trade unions, and their thinking, I suppose, if you can call it that, is influential on the wider left, particularly when it comes down to the role of American imperialism in the modern world. But the truth is that the Communist Party basically lost from the 1940s right the way through to its demise in terms of mobilising, younger people. It was bypassed by the first big popular social movement of the Cold War, the campaign for nuclear disarmament, the Aldermaston marches and all the rest of it, was left behind by all of that. It had nothing whatsoever to say about the 1960s student radicalism. Very little to do with feminism or with other kind of radical movements of the 70s and 80s, environmentalism and so forth. The one place that it remained important was the trade unions, where the Communist Party industrial organisation retained serious influence until well into the 1980s, and the remnants of that are still there. The story of the Communist Party in the Cold War is one of failure after failure after failure.
Kevin, is there anything you'd like to say on that?
I think it would be worth pointing out that one of the assets of the Communist Party during this period of decolonisation, the wind down of the British Empire, was the large network of left nationalist leaders that had studied in London that the party had engaged with over three or four decades, actually. And many of these were coming to prominence in independence movements that were going to be, and indeed were, empowered by the Labour Party and subsequent governments in the post-war period. And the Communist Party did play quite a leading role in encouraging independence movements, campaigning for decolonisation. And this added to its credibility, but many of the campaigns in which it was involved were, of course, articulated with Cold War struggles. They were nationalist movements that were, in some cases, proxy Cold War agencies in these underdeveloped countries. And the story was much more complicated than the liberating, emancipating theme that the party managed to associate with itself through those decades.
Many people during that time saw the Communist Party as a kind of vehicle of the Soviet intelligence services. Can we just talk a little bit about the Communist Party and espionage?
That is the subject of many books, it's quite difficult to give a rounded answer. But there's no doubt whatsoever that authorities in Moscow used the Communist Party of Great Britain in order essentially to pick up as many facts as possible about how to manufacture this or that military hardware or what have you. In other words, industrial espionage, particularly in military areas in the military sphere, was something that the CPGB was doing from the 1920s onwards. So ARCOS, which was the Soviet co-op organization which had a London office, was busted for spying. There were various senior communists who were found to be snooping on the Woolwich Arsenal, and so it goes on. Of course, what most people think about with all of this, the espionage role, if you like, of communists in Britain, is the Cambridge spies, Philby, Burgess MacLean, and all of that. Where essentially they weren't overt Communist Party members, although they were very definitely communists and sympathetic to the communist cause, ended up in massively senior positions in British intelligence and told their Soviet masters everything that they knew. Now, how important these characters were is a matter for discussion. We still don't know everything there is to know. I would say that post-1945, there's very little to suggest that the Soviet Union used the Communist Party for very much in the intelligence sphere. There's the example of Melita Norwood, Stalin's granny, as she was described, who was revealed in, I think, the early noughties. It's certainly relatively recently, to have handed over various nuclear-related secrets. But I think there are grounds for scepticism. Certainly, Moscow wanted as much info as it could get about advanced military technologies in the West. In fact, it relied on that sort of espionage. How much of it there was, we really still don't know. And how much it changed is, I think, still up for question.
I think the last place that one would place a spy or a saboteur working for the Soviet Union would be in the Communist Party of Great Britain. I mean, first of all, they'd be rather easy to identify, very embarrassing, of course, when party members were found, like Melita Norwood, in sensitive jobs. And the party had next to no significant political clout either. Members certainly were, through the Cold War years, excluded from teaching posts, civil service posts, armed services roles. Their access to useful knowledge was rather limited. I think the Cambridge spies are a different thing altogether. I mean, they were recruited at the high point of anti-fascism, and as I've said before, really, I think the Communist Party never really understood fascism or how it could and needed to be resisted. But the Cambridge supplies did dedicate their lives, their covert lives, to supporting the Soviet Union against what they thought were forces in the British establishment that were not confronting fascism effectively. And it seems to me that they were wrong. You know, the Philbys, MacLean, Burgess, Blunt and the others were feeding a dictatorship with information that weakened Western Europe in the name of anti-fascism, that was a threat that the Soviet Union contributed to the strengthening of more than anybody else. It must have been a terrible moment for them when the non-aggression pact was signed and they saw that the purposes of the sacrifices they had made had disappeared from the historical scene. But at the same time, you know, the Soviet Union made the largest sacrifice in the Second World War when the head-to-head confrontation with fascism in Europe took real form and was prosecuted to the end. And I think that the anti-fascist moment was probably the motivation for the Cambridge spies, for many people that joined in the 1930s and stayed through to the bitter end of the Communist Party. They saw it as an anti-fascist force, whereas in fact its actual contribution on that front was a very mixed bag indeed.
Like what we're doing? Connect with us on Twitter at DryCleanerCast. Support the show by becoming a DryCleanerCast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/DryCleanerCast. That's patreon.com/DryCleanerCast.
1991 saw the fall of the Soviet Union and a Russian-sized vacuum for communists worldwide. What was this time like for the British Communist Party?
Paul and I were both quite active and involved at this point. I mean, I suppose the opening notes are sounded when Gorbachev becomes General Secretary of a weakening Soviet Union in the mid-1980s, 1985, and initiates a period of glasnost, perestroika, openness, restructuring, and a whole series of reforms and possible democratizations that were welcomed by the Euro-communists, the reformist communists in Britain, and by many people on the centre-left and indeed the right of British politics. It was a new thaw. It could have been, people thought, that the huge Soviet monolith might turn into something more social democratic, more open, more transformational, perhaps to pick up some of its former tarnished kind of vanguard glory and move into a new era. The Euro-communists were very excited, Labour was too, but it came too late to save the fortunes of the Communist Party of Great Britain, which was very small, arguing with itself at this time, shrinking in numbers, and in many cases very little different to the Labour Party. It was not a shot in the arm for them in terms of membership. The magazine of the period, Marxism Today, possibly it was a shot in terms of influence. I remember talking to Labour policymakers who used to tell me that they used to read Marxism Today before they went into their Kinnockite working groups to shape the future of the Labour Party. So they had influence, but the numbers behind them were diminishing. Of course, it's not long after these years that there's a coup attempt in the Soviet Union. And then, of course, in Poland, multi-party elections take place. Hungary opens its border. East Germans flood into Hungary. The Berlin Wall opens up. And the fortresses of Eastern Europe begin to fall. And this is the end of the Soviet Union as we'd known it and as we've been talking about it in this discussion. And really, by then, the individuals remaining in the Communist Party really know the game is up. They're a warring splinter of what they used to be. And in 1991, I think it was, the non-Leninist movement, Democratic Left, was set up and becomes the legacy of the Communist Party, and has the residue of the Moscow gold in its coffers, and reclaims buildings from well-funded regional organisations. Lots of legal battles to get the assets back into the legal inheritor of the Communist Party's wealth. Do dominate actually quite a lot of what's going on in Democratic Left at the time. Paul and I are both working there on its newspaper New Times within 7 or 8 years of the the organisation being set up. Democratic Left, of course, only lasts, doesn't last 10 years, and it passes its assets across to Charter 88 and then to an electoral reform organisation really called Unlocking Democracy. It had tried to do something new. It had Democratic Left had tried to network campaigns. It had campaigned very strongly on fair voting and electoral reform, and it had quite a good network and initiative called Unions 21, which was trying to renew and strengthen trade unionism in the period. But really, it was shrinking for nearly all, shrinking year on year from the day that it was set up. The Stalinists in the Communist Party that it had defeated never gave up. Defeated Stalinists never do really give up, and a number of organisations, the New Communist Party, Straight Left becomes the Communist Party of Britain, I think, the Morning Star endures, but these are fragments, they're tiny, they're like those that the party was originally assembled from. The wheel had turned full circle. We have a number of rather ill-fitting fragments jostling around what was left of the Communist Party of Great Britain by the end of the 1990s. It was nearly game over, and good riddance too, many people thought. But then, of course, along came Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, and the story changed once again.
In 2001, we saw the beginning of the War on Terror after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. The USA and NATO first invaded Afghanistan in 2002. Then in 2003, the USA with the UK and a much smaller alliance controversially invaded Iraq. Both events have rocked the world order, and we've seen a rise in terrorism partly as a consequence of these events. We've also had the great financial crisis of 2007 and 2008, which has led to mass unemployment and great misery for many through the austerity measures in the UK and Europe. We have also seen a vote for the UK to leave the European Union, and in the USA we've seen the controversial election of Donald Trump as President of the United States. We also saw a Labour government that won a landslide in 1997, and then it grew deeply unpopular and led to them losing the general election of 2010. Another big question: what is the state of communism in the British left today?
That's a very interesting question. We're living in a very, very weird world. I suppose I'd make three points. The first is that, well, economic crisis rarely propels the electorate to the left. And in Britain, the left has not made, or never made, its take on the late noughties crash in 2008, the common sense of the day. And it hasn't, basically the left hasn't made its analysis, if you like, the common sense of the day anywhere, except perhaps for Portugal. So although we're living in difficult times economically throughout the world, really, the left hasn't been the beneficiary of capitalist failure. The second point I suppose I'd make is that 9/11 and its aftermath, the Afghanistan and Iraq wars and so forth, had and, well, continue to have a quite ambiguous impact on politics in the developed Western world. On one hand, it's led to a revival of sorts of an anti-imperialist, or, well, actually anti-American leftism that owes quite a lot to Cold War communist thinking. And, well, I think the rise of Jeremy Corbyn is very much part of that. On the other hand, the post-9/11 world has seen a growth of anti-foreigner nationalism, which, rather more important, it seems to me, or rather more prevalent than anti-Americanism. Hence Brexit, Donald Trump, and an awful lot more. The third point, I suppose, is that, well, okay, despite the way that a lot of the left in the West has taken on the ideas of Cold War era communist anti-Americanism, there's not really been a significant growth in support for the parties that claim the mantle of Lenin's Bolsheviks in Britain or anywhere else. I mean, here the Communist Party of Britain, the Socialist Workers' Party and all the rest, are they're microscopic sects, as Kevin was saying, just as they were microscopic sects 20 years ago. And elsewhere in Western Europe, the mass communist parties that were, well, quite normal in the 60s and 70s and 80s in France, Italy, in Spain, are a thing of the past. Communism today is very much a Southeast Asian thing. It's China, Vietnam, North Korea.
I think that it's true to say that leading figures in the Labour Party today have forgotten what Labour once knew, which is that Bolshevism is a poisoned well, that it produces the opposite of what it promises, and that it has never had the support of a large percentage of the British people. It leads to something dictatorial and top-down and statist and authoritarian in form, rather than anything that one would call socialism today with democratic content. Now, I'm not saying, it would be ridiculous to say, that the Labour Party that we have today is Bolshevik. That's not the case. But it is the air that many of its leading figures breathed when they first came into politics. And there are figures like Andrew Murray and Seamus Milne that are actually a direct intake from the Communist Party and Bolshevik micro-tradition in English politics. And then, in addition to that, figures like Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott and John McDonnell, these are people that Paul and I have known of or written about for many years. They come from the Labour left of the 1970s, the Bennite left, which very much was dependent on the Communist Party's trade union machine for organisational sinews, for resources, and indeed for ideas about policy. And they also come from a milieu in which the modern Bolshevism's Trotskyist strains were blooming in and around the Labour Party of the time. And I think these have had a huge effect on their thinking, their political concepts, their ideas of campaigning and strategy. And I think that the main effect of that is that they're actually not comfortable with a lot of the things that we do need Labour leaderships to be comfortable with. So they're not comfortable with the language of reform. They're not comfortable with the language of mixed economy. They're certainly not comfortable with the language of Americanism or of international military alliances and let alone interventions. I mean, a President Trump chimes much more closely with their notions of international politics than a reforming Obama that also has obligations in terms of policing the world and managing kind of balance of armaments. It's something that they were never schooled in. It's the old phrase. They come from an oppositional left, and the modern Bolshevik tradition was very close to the pulse of that oppositional left. And I think that the long-standing Bolshevik critique of Labour actually fuels a lot of their hesitations, their difficulties to adjust to reform and the actually existing electoral opportunities that the leadership is now gradually adjusting to, but possibly too little too late. I was very much part of that left tradition back in the 70s and through the 80s, and I worked alongside a number of these people quite closely, and I'm afraid I can smell the Leninist tradition on their breath, and I think that Labour has forgotten what it learnt during the 80 years or so that followed the Bolshevik Revolution, and we're now finding ourselves in a situation where we have regular repetitions almost of the non-aggression pact from the beginning of the Second World War. I think some of the ridiculous positions that people have talked themselves into over Syria, over the Ukraine, over the Crimea, over Putin, and before that, with Gaddafi and with Saddam, show that there is a kind of legacy and a set of political parameters that are anachronistic and that have been brought into the period in which we now live, and they are antiques from that Bolshevik period, and that is a concern to me, that the culture and the thinking and the approach to global politics is permeated by the tradition that Labour used to keep very much at arm's length, but now has sitting around the shadow cabinet table.
A bit of a footnote to what Kevin was just saying. it seems to me that the core of Leninism that Corbyn and his part of the Labour left, which is by no means the whole of the Labour left, has taken on, is a rather crude anti-Americanism. It's an anti-imperialist anti-Americanism, which has led them into all sorts of very unsavoury international kind of alliances and friendships, in particular supporting anti-American dictators in the Middle East, so Saddam, Assad, etc., 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 but also into rose-tinted spectacles when looking at Venezuela, pro-Cubanism, all of these things. And that is, it's almost a knee-jerk kind of leftist kind of anti-Americanism that runs all the way through the Corbyn Labour left. And that is something that I think is, well, one, idiotic, but two, wrong. Beyond that, though, in terms of the actual influence of the Communist Party, we've explained already that the Communist Party of Great Britain, the official Communist Party, ceased to exist in 1991. So the main Communist Party today is the Communist Party of Britain, which controls the Morning Star newspaper. But there's no formal relationship at all with the Labour Party. What you're looking at is a number of people who have pasts in the Communist Party of Britain, holding roles in affiliated trade unions that are affiliated to the Labour Party. And that is pretty much it. Otherwise, we're looking at a broader intellectual influence, a mindset, all those sorts of things, which I think, talked about already. I'm worried not about entryism or anything like that, although there's certainly been a certain amount of that from Trotskyists and other Leninists in the Labour Party over the last couple of years, but more the influence of a rather idiotic worldview, which frankly was wrong and out of date in 1939 when Molotov signed the pact with Ribbentrop, and hasn't got any more up to date, if you like, in the last 75 years.
In some far left and anti-capitalist circles today, there is a growing rosy-eyed revisionism of the legacy of Soviet Russia and other communist countries. What, in your view, is the legacy of Karl Marx and communism today? Was it a force for good that just went bad, or will Marxism always lead to totalitarian states? Or is there something positive we can take from Marx without having to become full-blown communists?
I think it's a big mistake to blame Marx for communist totalitarianism as a starting point. There are, nevertheless, undoubtedly authoritarian elements in Marx's thinking. And there's also plenty that Marx got wrong about how capitalism would develop, as well as plenty of blind spots. Marx doesn't have anything to say about sex. He doesn't have anything to say about bureaucracy. He doesn't have an awful lot to say about, really, about technology. Despite all of the he's a 19th century thinker. Despite all of the failings which you would expect from anyone, I don't think that Marx is any more fallible necessarily than John Stuart Mill or contemporary or Darwin. But okay, there are lots of insights too. I wouldn't describe myself as a Marxist, but it's perfectly possible to be a Marxist, democratic socialist, and libertarian, and I know plenty of people who are just that. I don't think that Marxism leads to dictatorship, but at the same time, the seeds of it are undoubtedly there in the master's thoughts.
I think I take a slightly different view on this. I mean, I think that Marx provides a very useful, if 19th century, analysis of capitalism. And I also think he provides ways of thinking about the capacities and dynamics of the forces that might modify or transcend capitalism at some point. But the left is bigger than Marx. Even though he's still useful, I think that the real threat has always been that poisonous mix of Marxism-Leninism that no doubt has had the legacy of dictatorship that people have been referring to. I look at the left in a different way. I think there was a very important left that predates the Bolshevik tradition and Marxism-Leninism, and it postdates it too. I think there's always been a healthy non-Leninist left in British politics. If I tried to track it, it would be from somewhere back in the William Morris and then the Independent Labour Party, of which the young J.B. Priestley was a member, rolling forward to Orwell, to some of the socialist initiatives in the Second World War, like Commonwealth, to the emergence of the New Left, to the Labour Left, to the Tribune Left, the Soft Left, and to a lot of independent initiatives that have happened in and around the party, beyond the fragments, the social movements that followed on from that. And I think that although that's a very diverse bunch, with a very diverse mix of attitudes to Marx on top of everything else, there are some common themes. It's non-statist, it talks about alternative plans and popular control and ethical socialism and gender equalities and popular planning and being in and against the state. And culturally, it's often significantly libertarian. It predates the Communist Party and it postdates it. And it's self-financing, which of course we could never say about the Communist Party tradition. And I think it's a real alternative to the Bolshevik import and to the traditional narrow parliamentarism of the Labour Party.
Paul and Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. Where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
I mean, the easiest thing to do is to, catch up on us on Arc Press, which is a small press where we're publishing. Arc has got four A's, RGH exclamation mark.
That's not our credit rating.
You can get books and e-books online via Amazon. Oh no, I'm doing a commercial for a giant multinational corporation.
I think it would be fair to say, and Paul should say this for himself really, you know, that these arguments take a different form when you look at China and Britain, but there's a whole parallel story to tell there, and Paul's working on a book on Maoism, the British left, which looks at a kind of parallel, if you like, set of pressures on left thinking in the United Kingdom. I'm a bit more stuck in the past. I've been working on I've just completed a book for ARG, which amongst other things looks at those movements immediately after the First World War in the context of a very small town in Kent, Whitstable, and I'm following that with something that looks at fascism and war and radio and why socialists followed Mosley from the Labour Party through the New Party and into British fascism. These big questions never go away, you know. They're here to stay, and someone's got to carry on writing about them, and that's what we are doing.
Excellent. Well, hopefully I can get you back on at some point to talk about Mao and all that sort of thing. We'd definitely love to do some future episodes on this topic. Thank you guys so much for your thoughts today and chatting with me and taking the time. Really enjoyed the show. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yes, it's been very interesting.
Like what we're doing? Connect with us on Twitter at DryCleanerCast. Support the show by becoming a DryCleanerCast Patreon subscriber today. Go to patreon.com/DryCleanerCast. That's patreon.com/DryCleanerCast. Thanks for listening.